Well, good evening, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And if you're out there across America, why, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us the publisher of a book called The War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked on September 11, 2001. It's written by Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed. He's from the Institute of Policy Research and Development over in Great Britain. And he's written extensively on many, many subjects. This is a very, very provocative book. Now, this is being published here in the United States by Mr. John Leonard. And I think you'll find our discussion tonight really very, very enlightening, because the author of the book has analyzed the events that led up to the war in Afghanistan. I'm talking about the war between 1980 and 1988, the so-called Afghan War, where the United States CIA funded the Mujahideen in their battle against the Soviets, and then, of course, during that period of time, indoctrinated them in this radical form of Islam. In fact, brought this radical form of Islam, which had laid dormant in Saudi Arabia for decades, for almost 100 years, brought it back to life with a vengeance, and convinced the Afghan fighters that that Allah had given them the victory. In fact, they could accomplish anything, because now Allah was on their side. Allah wanted them to form a true Muslim community, a Muslim society in Afghanistan, and spread it throughout the world. And, of course, pushing this violent form of Islam, American intelligence officers began to build up what today we refer to as the best enemies money can buy. Mr. Leonard, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
Well, now, Tursa, are you a regular book publisher, or is this something that you've taken on in recent years?
Actually, last year.
All right, fine. And how did you happen to get the opportunity to publish this book? Is this published in both the United States and Great Britain?
It's being distributed in Britain. We might find a publisher for it there. We're looking.
No, but you are actually the primary publisher then.
That's right.
Well, the gentleman who wrote this book has a tremendous, tremendous insight and understanding of what's going on there in the Middle East, doesn't he?
Well, yes, he's quite a researcher.
All right. Now, what are your thoughts as far as the message of this book? What is the major message of this book?
Well, to me, it says a little bit more than just 9/11. I think you summed it up, 9/11, pretty well with the phrase, the best enemies that money can buy. We've seen the best democracy money can buy. And we are a superpower that seems to need a war once in a while. It seems to need a pretext for war, needs a provocation. That's, to me, part of the lesson is how we have always gotten into war through one of these kind of things. It's gotten me to look at the history, the track record of the United States in foreign wars, and I find that when we wrote the book, I had left out Korea. I hadn't researched that, and the latest thing I came up with is that it was also an arranged thing where the South Koreans went over the border and then they were counterattacked, and that was framed as a invasion, and had to be stopped to save the Western world or something.
Well, I think in the foreword to the book, you write, in the War on Freedom, British scholar Nafsi M. Ahmed writes with cool, factual understanding or understatement, a story that begs comprehension. compelling evidence that the U.S. government instigates terrorism as a perfect pretext to justify an aggressive foreign policy up to including the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. What you are suggesting is that our intelligence services failed to thwart the 9/11 project, that our government immediately pointed to Osama bin Laden as the culprit behind it, and yet steadfastly refused to release any of the evidence we had that he was involved. Immediately after the attack, why, of course, movements were taken, not so much to curb the terrorists, but to curb American freedom.
That's right.
And certainly through the USA Patriot Act, the Office of Homeland Security, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, the TIPS program, the movements at every turn to restrict the freedom of the American people. What's so amazing about the USA Patriot Act is it has nothing to do with Muslim terrorists. It has to do with American freedom and anybody who dissents against our government.
Yeah.
In fact, the whole movement, people must understand, we're not trying to stop terrorism. We haven't sealed our borders for a full year after the 9/11 attack. We allowed people to come into this country from Saudi Arabia without checking their visas at all, without applying the same laws we would apply to everybody else.
Yeah.
From people from Saudi Arabia, despite the fact that 15 of the 19 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia. And, of course, there's so much evidence that the Saudi Arabian government, or at least people highly placed in the government, two of the princes, certainly a number of very, very wealthy Saudis and a number of foundations and charities in Saudi Arabia actually were aligned with Osama bin Laden, aligned with al-Qaeda, and our government is doing everything not to expose them but to protect them. So the idea that we're really fighting terrorism, well, we're fighting terrorism on one hand, but on the other hand, what we're really doing is using the battle against terrorism to justify ever more controls over the American people. And, of course, there's no question at all that there will be more terrorist attacks in America. And the question is, why aren't we doing what's logical to try to stop them? Why are we continuing to allow people to come into this country, flooding across our borders, increasing numbers of people from Middle Eastern countries, and when the INS tries to deport them, of course, every barrier is put in their way. Well, now, what are some of the major things you'd like to talk about this evening as far as what's happened?
Well, just at that last point, I think the reason that nothing has changed on the score of the visas is it's business as usual, because the whole thing was a setup, and they're not really worried about terrorists, authentic terrorists. There are real terrorists. I mean, there are people that get so upset that they think this is the way they have to take the law into their hands. But as I research this more and more, I find that even what we know, what we've been told in history about Bolsheviks and agitators and anarchists and all this, a great deal of that even in the 19th century was actually being steered by state intelligence organizations, maybe the British or the Prussian or so on. So for, I think one really useful indicator is whether somebody comes out with a platform and says, okay, we've done this because we want that, and we've made some demands. When it's just quiet, well, then what you've got is a setup by a state intelligence agency.
Well, I think one of the most shocking things that I've learned in my analysis is the funding of the communist movement, both here in the United States and certainly in the Soviet Union. And first, you go into the background of the funding of the Soviet Union, you find out tremendous amounts of money funded from the West, American corporations, Federal Reserve System, American corporations going in and building up the industry there, knowing full well they'd never get any money out, but obviously they had another agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, here in the United States, time and time again, we find evidence of the communist front organizations being funded by American corporations and certainly by American foundations. And the book Foundations, their power and influence, covers that beautifully. It's the only congressional investigation that's been allowed. during the last 50 years. But it's very obvious as you read this book, the Rockefeller, Ford, and other foundations were funding pro-communist movements. Now, we could carry that over then to the terrorist movements. Certainly, we know that the terrorist movements were getting a lot of their funding from the United States. We have testimony in 1996 by, and it's included in Stephen Emerson's excellent book on the American Jihad, and quoting a testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee in 1996, pointing out that Hamas and all of these Islamic terrorist movement organizations are being funded from the United States. The Intelligence Committee knew it, but nothing was done to stop that funding until after September 11th, and then we're suddenly horrified to find out what's been going on, and we're going to have to, of course, to move dramatically to stop it. But why didn't they stop it beforehand when they knew that we were funding people who were killing people over in the Middle East? And in many instances, we're killing Americans in the Middle East, as we saw certainly with the attack on the American embassy and the American Marine barracks there in Lebanon back in 1983.
Well, what you'll find is that the elites that are pulling the strings don't care about their fellow citizens. They may think that we are just some kind of unwashed, that we really don't count. I've been following the line of research on Skull and Bones. I see you've had recently a talk on that.
We've had a number of talks on.
Yeah, they refer to the rest of the world as the barbarians. I mean, so we're not like Americans. We're just some sort of underclass that's there to be walked on. So if they blow up a few Americans or a few something else, I don't think they care too much.
All right, well, the author of the book, War on Freedom, doesn't come right on and say the Bush administration was responsible for the attack, but he calls for a full and independent investigation. Now, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a little bit more, maybe I'm older. I read that FDR had 10 investigations of Pearl Harbor, and always it was the same thing, and now you see it, now you don't, pull the dossiers out from under their noses and clean them up. And it was just a kind of a game of cat and mouse, and they never caught him. And here we're not even having one investigation, but the one we had, the two chairmen, I think were the two fellows who were sitting with General Mahmoud, I believe the name is, the day he was, on the morning of the September 11th, and he had just wired $100,000 to Mohammed Atta.
You're speaking of his name was Mohammed Ahmed, General Mohammed Ahmed. He was the head of the Pakistani intelligence.
Right.
And, of course, he was meeting, at least it is said, on September 11th.
Florida, right?
With this gentleman from the Republican congressman. Was it Goss? I think it is.
So it's the wolves watching the chickens.
Right.
That's the kind of investigation they're going to give us. And the real hope would be that the media would conduct some investigation. And I've been following that line of thought. I'm afraid that I'm just kind of really a Johnny-come-lately that's going back and following up lines of research that sort of the New World Order people have been on to for quite a while. So I'm putting a lot of this stuff into the update to the book, like Operation Mockingbird, how I think it started under with Alan Dulles at the end of the 40s. To basically buy journalists, as the oft-quoted remark that a good journalist was cheaper than a good call girl. And the I don't know if they still do it that way. I think they more just sort of buy up all the newspapers into one cartel, and then they don't have to buy individual journalists.
Well, of course, I think that there's a great deal of truth in that. Actually, we have a list of CIA assets in a book called Regicide. It was basically turned over to a journalist named Gregory Douglas by Mr. Robert Crowley, who was in charge of the covert operations of the CIA. And when Mr. Crowley died, then Mr. Douglas published this in his book, Regicide. There's a list of 4,000 CIA assets, people who are associated with the CIA and take the retired intelligence officer's publication. And it's amazing how many of these are television anchors, prominent television, and the media people. In fact, one of them was my next-door neighbor, who I always noticed watched me very, very closely. a very prominent, very successful doctor in my community. And so I put a great deal of credence in that list, and it certainly it names many, many people within the media as very, very favorable to the CIA. Of course, we know that the Skull and Bones has had cells within the CIA for many years. We know that the directorship of the council of the CIA almost always comes from in the Council on Foreign Relations.
This Robert Lovett guy,
right?
Bonesman, who actually started the CIA. So,
right. Well, of course, the problem is, how do we get the truth to the American people? That's what I do, and of course, that's what you're doing in your book.
That's what this book is maybe about. That perhaps they've over. Stepped the bounds here with the World Trade Center. That was a bit maybe too much, and so far they're holding very well. I think 99% of people would be shocked and horrified to hear us talking this way. But I think there's a chance that this is the hook that we can kind of finally get them on.
Well, you know, today the House of Representatives voted for an independent investigation. Now, that will go to the Senate. The president has been trying to prevent an independent investigation. He said, well, we can have an independent investigation, but I want to appoint the chairman. I want to control the investigation to make sure that I wasn't involved, which is exactly what FDR did, what happened with Lyndon Johnson with the investigation of the murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Yeah.
And so you appoint another investigation and you have interminable hearings, and of course you only call the people you want to, and you never get the people there who are going to tell the truth. Or if they do tell the truth, you demonize them, you attack them, you ask them three questions at one time so that they can't think them through. And there are all these techniques that are used to discombobulate a witness so that, and then of course if they do get the truth out, why one means or another, why they, when they record that truth, it just doesn't get recorded quite right.
Mm-hmm.
Or they misspell words, and that's one of the things they're great on, is misspelling names so you can't figure out who they're talking about. Well, anyway, of course, now, in your opinion, did the government let this happen, or did the CIA in some way allow this to happen, the Central Intelligence Agency?
The Lee Hop, the let it happen on purpose theory, and to me it seems the more, I like this story about the scientific method is the hypothesis that's the simplest and explains the most facts is the shortest line between A and B. And to come up with this let it happen on purpose actually is a circuitous route, because you're positing two entities. One, a U.S. government that just on its day off decides it's going to let something happen that it's job to stop. And this other entity, which is over there coming out of some caves with some kind of high-tech way of hijacking Boeings. And so it's a more complicated model, whereas you say, well, basically, we know that there's all these connections between Bin Laden and the Afghan Mujahideen, and
well, there's always relations between Bin Laden and his family and the Bush family.
Yeah, when you see all this as one structure, it's much simpler to say, well, you know, this is the you only need one basically actor for the thing to happen, and that's easier. That makes more sense.
Well, now, what is the point, though, that you're making?
Well, maybe I didn't explain it very well, but I'm saying that it's much simpler to assume that some kind of clique within the CIA arranged the whole thing from start to finish.
Or did they think perhaps just knew it was going to happen, it did nothing, because, as is so well pointed out in this book, War on Freedom, we had intended to go to war in the Middle East long before the September 11th attack, and of course we'd been planning on that. In fact, it was in July of 2001, several months before the attack, when the Pakistani foreign minister, a man named Mr. Niaz Nayak, was told by high-ranking government officials that the United States would be at war in Afghanistan by October of 2001. Now, how could they possibly know that when the attack didn't occur until September 11th?
Well, I have trouble with the let it happen on purpose theory. Just who are these people, and how do they manage to pull it off without actually, some of them were trained in army camps, some of the alleged hijackers. It's just too strange and too fishy.
Well, you know, Chris, I think for our listeners out there,
I mean, maybe at the end it doesn't really make that much difference. Maybe you're getting down to a point where it's so murky, where that the letting it happen on purpose and the and it being arranged by the CIA is almost the same thing, because you're working with proxies, and these proxies may not even know who's really pulling the strings on them. So you have one part of the, I think most of the CIA, probably over 90% of it, are people really on the up and up. The CIA's charter has, you know, they probably obey the CIA's charter. So when I say CIA, it's just kind of a shorthand for a rogue element.
Well, there seems to be a government within the government,
yeah.
A CIA within the CIA. And in the book entitled See No Evil by Robert Baer, which we've quoted in the past, Robert Baer was a CIA operative for well over 20 years. He was the CIA station chief in northern Iraq, and that would be in Kurdistan, which was not controlled by Saddam Hussein in 1995. And in that book, of course, he tells how time and again the Iraq military wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and time and again we not only refused to help them, we actually betrayed them so that the perpetrators, the conspirators against Saddam, our arch enemy, of course, were captured and tortured and killed.
Do you think Saddam is still CIA asset?
I don't know whether he is or not. I don't really think so. I think that he is one of the finest enemies that money could buy. But, of course, in that book, and I think this is probably the worth the entire cost of the book, in the foreword to the book, or the preface to the book, Mr. Baer quotes a reporter who had told him that one of the highest-ranking CIA officials had said, off the record, of course, that when the dust settled after September 11th, why the American people would realize that what happened was not a failure for our intelligence agencies, but a triumph. Now, if you stop and contemplate what the significance of this, September 11th was not a failure for our intelligence agencies, but a triumph. How could it be a triumph? There were 3,000 Americans dead, unless the ultimate goal was to get us into a war in the Middle East. And just as the attack on Pearl Harbor was designed to get us into a war with Adolf Hitler, so the attack on the World Trade Center would get us into a war in the Middle East and plunge us into this third world war against radical Islam. And I really believe that this is exactly what's going to happen, and I hope and pray that I'm wrong, but I feel we're moving into a war in the Middle East will involve far more than Iraq and inflame the entire Muslim world against the United States. And, of course, whenever you start a war, you never know what's going to happen. But one of the things that will happen, I'm firmly convinced, is an attack on our financial infrastructure. And, of course, an attack on the dollar could very well destroy the infrastructure of this country, because we are built on the fiat money system. We're built on this concept of Western concept of banking. And if the Muslims go to a gold-backed currency, why the entire infrastructure of America will crumble,
well,
literally overnight.
Know, one reason they say that they're after Saddam Hussein is because he's taken Iraq onto the euro. He wants to sell his oil for euros.
And I hadn't heard that. Is that really true?
Oh, yeah. He's on the euro since a year or two ago. And that may be why they're after him. There's a fear that if the rest of the OPEC goes over to the euro, then your bankers won't be able to print their greenbacks for oil anymore, your Federal Reserve notes.
Well, it's going to be very, very easy to, it's going to be, really, I believe that when we do go to war with Iraq, and there's no question we will inflame 1.2 billion Muslims, and they will unite against us. And whether they, are anti-American citizen or not, they will be anti-American government. Because, of course, they will feel that we certainly, like the Crusaders of old, are attacking Islam.
Yes. Well, I think it's clear that Islam is just very convenient now as a substitute for communism, which was kind of the standard brand for 70 years, like the finest enemy we could have for and they just wore the poor buggers out. They couldn't keep going.
Well, they never could have kept going for 70 years had it not been for constant infusions of aid and technology from the West. And for our listeners out there who do not understand that we always funded communism all the time, saying what a terrible, wicked enemy it was, I suggest the books, the three books by Professor Sutton, written while he was at the Hoover Institute in Stanford University, Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, and then his subsequent book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, and then his other book, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy, or my interview with Professor Sutton, where we cover this whole scam and how all during the Vietnam War we were financing the North Vietnamese through our constant infusion of aid and technology into the Soviet Union that was funding the North Vietnamese, because North Vietnam could never have kept that war going for 10 years without constant infusions of military aid from Russia, and we were giving loans to Russia all during that time, most of which we've written off. But, of course, we'd never want to let the American people know that. They might begin to question why we would subsidize the people who were financing our enemy that was killing our boys, unless, of course, we understand that Vietnam had nothing to do with fighting communism. It had to do with changing America.
Well, they also say that there was a drug connection there, the Golden Triangle, and Afghanistan also. Now that they've thrown out the Taliban, the opium is flowing again. And the CIA has, there's a lot of work on CIA and drugs. And these Skull and Bones also, they got their start from a drug, opium, back in the 1830s.
Right, that was Mr. Russell, who created the Skull and Bones organization. His family was deeply involved in drugs. And now that, of course, we've destroyed the Taliban that was controlling the drugs, our good allies, the Northern Alliance, has drugs in full production again.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, I think that what is so beautifully brought out in this book is the brutality not only of the Taliban, but the brutality of the Northern Alliance, who we supported. Now, I don't think we should have been supporting either side, but the Northern Alliance that we did support was brutal. It was raping, it was killing, it was pillaging. And, of course, a country that's been at war for over 20 years, and, you know, 5 million people have, fled the country, a million and a half to a million people slaughtered during these wars, and many of them killed, by American bombing over there. What a tragic, tragic country this is. And it seems that our major interest is really not, freedom or democracy, because, of course, the Karzai, who we put into power, was not democratically elected. We're not interested in democracy, although we talk about it. We're interested, of course, in a stable society so we can build our pipelines across there. And then I really think the other reason is the justification for going to war with Iraq, because this has been planned long, long, long before the attack on the World Trade Center. And that's really covered in this book, War and Freedom, isn't it?
Yes. With the Taliban, of course, they were practically put in there by the U.S., in the hopes that they would approve this oil pipeline for UNICAL. Karzai is the old UNICAL consultant on that job.
That's the new president who installed, worked for UNICAL oil company. Isn't that a coincidence?
And the other thing I didn't know before I read that manuscript was that the Soviet invasion was they were lured in there by the CIA. There was some kind of different cliques and political sects were fighting each other, and apparently we got our people to overstep the line that we knew that the Soviets wouldn't put up with. And Zbigniew afterwards said, well, wasn't that a great coup? Because this helped to lead to the downfall of the great evil empire, but of course on the backs of millions of Afghan refugees.
Well, we're going to have to take a break here, and when we get back, we will, of course, invite your calls. It's 464-8295 or out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. This is a very, very important subject, and this book is very well done. It certainly goes into the fact that there was abundant advanced knowledge. We'll talk more about that then when we get back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you out there will decide right now you're going to help what do us us do what we do 5 hours every day by joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. If what we say is true, then your future, your freedom, your friends, your family are all in jeopardy today. Because once freedom is lost, why, it will never be regained again during our lifetime. And we are suggesting that there are dark forces at work within our society, within our government, that have a different agenda. And that is, their real objective is not only expanding America's hegemony all over the world, but of course a new world order and a new world religion. And of course, if indeed our government knew the attack was coming and did nothing to thwart that, why, of course, somebody should be sent to prison. Now, for those of you who have any question what really happened on September 11th, I suggest give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIP-WAR. And if you haven't had a copy of our newsletter before, we'll send you a free copy of my October newsletter, which is basically the testimony of a woman named Kristen Breitweiser before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the 18th of September of this year. And in that testimony, she talks about her husband, Ron Breitweiser, who died in the South Tower after being told, no, don't leave your post. I mean, you have nothing to worry about. Stay on your job. Although the Port Authority that was putting out this information was in touch with the airport and knew that another hijacked airliner was bearing down on New York City. And, of course, then she gets into the background of the fact that the government said that they had no idea, absolutely no idea an attack was coming. And yet, of course, if you study the information that was readily available, of course they knew an attack was coming. They'd known for years that the Islamists had been planning on hijacking our airliners and crashing them into our buildings, and specifically the World Trade Center. And then she discusses all of the sources of information, much of what we had already known, but much of what she had come up with on her own. And then she pointed out that this statement, we had no idea an attack was coming, and yet, according to the New York Times, within just hours of the attack, agents of the FBI were at the homes where the hijackers lived, at the restaurants where they worked, where they ate, at the air training at the flight schools where they had trained. And if they had no idea who they were or the attack was coming, how within hours were they able to be checking these people out so thoroughly? How is that possible if they didn't have any idea who these people were ahead of time? Well, the answer should be very, very obvious. They did know ahead of time. And then, of course, if you begin to study this, you find out that the FBI agents who wanted to investigate this were blocked at every turn. But the letter that we've put out, the October newsletter, goes into great detail, and it just simply reproduces her testimony which has not been picked up well by the general media. And so we would like to suggest, if you give us a call, read her testimony and then understand the implications of what she's saying. The fact that that testimony was given on the 18th of September of this year, that the video cameras were rolling, the reporters were all there, and that somebody spiked these stories so that they weren't seen on the evening news, is simply as another reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. So we'd be glad to send you a copy. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for the October newsletter. And then we hope that many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Remember our website. It's radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can get our newsletters there. You're welcome to copy them. You can find our live radio programs, our archive radio programs. And we hope that many of you will tell others about our programs, because we're going to have to get the information, the truth out, person to person. We're not going to ever have access to the television. I was only on the nationwide television one time, and almost immediately afterwards, why, they canceled the contract for the woman. Her name was Jane Whitney, who had me on this nationwide program discussing the AIDS epidemic. So, you know, if you are in the media and you do not toe the line, you lose your job. Anybody who questions that, you need to get the book entitled Into the Buzzsaw, written by Christian Borgensen, who was an award-winning Emmy television producer for CBS, until she tried to get the truth out about the downing of TWA 800. And, of course, she found out what the buzzsaw was all about. Her book, Into the Buzzsaw, is 18 essays by 18 people within the media who tried to get the truth out and found out what happens when you try to tell the truth and you work for the establishment. So we do not have a free press in America. Fortunately, we still have enough radio stations that will let us buy time to get the truth out, at least in your area. We need to reach the rest of the nation as quickly as we can. And so if you believe there's a problem and you'd like to partner with us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure, remember our telephone number? It's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because America's been at war for a long time, but soon we'll be entering the Third World War. And it will not simply be on the streets of Baghdad and Basra that blood will flow. I fear, having read the plans put out by the people who really run America, that there will be expanded attacks here in the United States, expanded terrorist attacks. In fact, we're already working in Washington, D.C. on a plan of what will happen in America after our government has been destroyed. It's entitled the Continuation of Continuity of Government Committee. We'll be having Howard Phillips come on in the near future to tell you about that committee, already planning on what will happen when the large part of the leaders of this country have been eliminated. Why would they be planning on what to do if, unless they had information, what the future holds? Again, our number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening, Mr. John Leonard, and the book we're talking about is The War on Freedom, and if you'd like any more information about that, you could call our 800 number for a suggested donation for the book. It's a very, very significant book. I think it probably is the best book that we have today written about the overall event that happened on September 11th, the events that led up to it, and of course that this was immediately used to change the relationship between Americans and their government, to massively expand the power of our central government with the Office of Homeland Security and the USA Patriot Act, and all of this new legislation and moving towards a federal police force. And yet we still have our borders open and allowing the terrorists to come in. We're still allowing them to come in, hundreds of thousands, well over 100, 150,000 people from terrorist nations have been allowed to come in since the terrorist attack. What's wrong with this picture? And maybe, of course, the American people are being deceived. And if you really want, of course, to get more information, go to my website, RadioLiberty.com, and look up our September newsletter, where we simply catalog all the things that have happened since the September 11th attack last year that point to the fact that the war on terrorism is really not a war on terrorism. It's a war on the freedom of the American people. Well, John Leonard is our guest today. The book is entitled The War on Freedom, and it's written by a gentleman in London. His name is Nafsi Mosaddegh Ahmed. I assume he's Muslim. He is Muslim, isn't he?
Oh, yes.
Okay. But he's from the Institute for Policy Research and Development in London. But certainly I think he's given a very fair and impartial evaluation of what's going on. Very, very direct to the point, well documented. And, of course, he points out the fact there was so much evidence that they had advanced knowledge that the attack was going to come. Do you want to cover any of those things, the things that he brings out in his book, and the fact that many, many people knew not only the approximate time, but what the target was going to be?
Well, I think I tried to summarize that in the foreword. There were all the intelligence warnings from foreign intelligence agencies. There was some interest, like the couple months before in Genoa, Italy, they had the World Trade Organization meeting, and they had the city ringed with anti-aircraft batteries, no-fly zone, because there was already a rumor that there would be a plane as bomb attack. And then after September 11th, they said, oh, we have never thought that a plane could be used as a bomb, when in fact the Pentagon financed a study exactly on that method or that kind of attack.
And that was in 1991, wasn't it?
Yeah, 93. A quarter of a million they spent on that.
A quarter of a million is the idea of them using, the terrorists using planes to attack our buildings. And yet Condoleezza Rice had the hypocrisy to say we never thought that they would use a plane.
And the odd thing is that this, apparently the idea was first thought of in 93 by the Pentagon. In 93 and 94, there were three incidents. So looks to me like these incidents were just a dry run. Some Algerians tried to run a plane into the Eiffel Tower and were stopped. It's kind of strange. Or were they the Algerians, you know, getting the CIA wire or something, the Pentagon wire down in Algiers?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that there is a book written in 1993. It was called Attack America and the West, written by Joseph Badansky, who was the director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare. Now, his 1993 book was totally suppressed in America. I've never been able to get a copy of the American edition. I had to get my copy out of Great Britain with a slightly different title, Attack the West. But, of course, in that book, he pointed out that between 1980 and 1985, they actually had camps in Iran where they were training terrorists how to hijack American planes. They had 747 there, 727s, several American planes, and they were training the Islamic terrorists to hijack our planes and crash them into buildings.
See, they being...
These were the Iranians. The Iranians were financing this whole movement.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, you can find that quotation, of course, in the New Yorker magazine, September 24th of last year, quotes Joseph Badansky making that statement. But we have his book, published in 1993, which may be why the Pentagon then did finance this study that concluded, yes, it would be a very, very good way for people who didn't care about their lives and would know that they'd immediately go to, or believe they'd go immediately to paradise to wreak havoc in our country. And the government knew that. But today, even to this day, they do not want the American people to know that they had foreknowledge, and that is unconscionable, and that's why we need an independent investigation. I fear, though, that it will be another cover-up. Let's hope and pray I'm wrong.
Yes.
All right, well, what's some of the other things that really were concerning you about this whole scenario that we've been told about?
Well, of course, there's the Bin Laden, Carlisle links.
Why don't you develop that, the Bin Laden-Carlisle link? What's that about? Because many of our listeners may not know what Carlisle is.
Carlisle is the fastest growing defense company during the last decade or so. I think it's grown in revenues about 10 times.
It's a multi-billion-dollar holding company that holds the rights to build the Bradley fighting vehicle, the mobile howitzer, ties to Grumman aircraft, which is ties to the military. And of course, Carlisle, why is Carlisle significant, this international combine?
Well, some of the first partners in Carlisle were an Arab named Mahfouz, the Bin Laden family, and the Bush family.
The Bush family?
And it said, oh, well, yes, George Sr. is still a consultant to Carlisle, which Judicial Watch wants him to resign as a conflict of interest, because what you basically have is that the son is waging wars, and they have their shares in Carlisle in a blind trust, so they're making money off the war.
No, you're not suggesting these people would make money off of the suffering of these people. And of course, there you also have men like James Baker III, who represented George Bush in Florida during the Battle of the Hanging Chads, Frank Carlucci, a number of the usual suspects from the Council on Foreign Relations, these people of great wealth, who started investing in this defense contractor, 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't understand why at that time they were interested in investing in the Bradley fighting vehicle. And the mobile howitzer was almost as if they were planning at that time in a desert war.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed at that time we were told there weren't going to be any more wars.
Yeah.
The war era of wars had ended. Now everything would be worked out peacefully.
Right.
It's almost as if Well, of course, your book almost suggests that a lot of this was scripted ahead of time, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Well, but this is really nothing new, like the grand chessboard idea of Brzezinski, that we have to play this great game in Eurasia to control the world.
And that was a book that Brzezinski wrote in 1997, The Grand Chessboard. It's well worthwhile reading to our listeners.
Yeah, we've quoted some of the most damning bits of it in the book, where he basically says we need something like 9/11 to mobilize the American people to go into Central Asia, because Americans don't normally think of that as their, you know, their sphere of action.
They would not be
happy to stay on this side of the water.
Something to the effect that we would not be able to organize or mobilize our multicultural society behind foreign policy unless there was a perceived direct external threat.
Something like Pearl Harbor.
That was his word, right.
But this is just rehashed 19th century British imperialism. It's nothing new. So when people tell me that, well, it's all because of Saddam Hussein decided to go over the euro, or I say, well, that doesn't explain why Palmerston was trying to hobble Egypt in 1840, which is something I also noted in the book.
Right.
It has been the strategy of the British Empire was always to break up any other attempted empire. In fact, they were the ones who got us into the Civil War, it seems. They're trying to keep the United States from becoming strong. And this is just carrying on with that. The threat has always been to the Anglo-American axis, that the continent of Eurasia would somehow unite and just sort of live in peace together and trade and build railroads and be a nice, happy economic bloc.
And so we really don't want that, because that would challenge our control there.
Well, that's right. So if we wanted to put it all in a nutshell, all of modern history, including this 9/11 incident, I'd say that's what it's really all about, unfortunately. And this is all very disillusioning, because we've all been trained to believe, you know, we are the guys on the white horse with the white helmet, and, you know, the bad guys are over there, Hitler or Stalin, and then you find out that our bankers put them both in power. It's incredible when you start doing the research. This is, of course, all very much suppressed, because it's all so damning.
Now, for our listeners, let me suggest the book Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler by Anthony Sutton.
Right.
Excellent, excellent book. As well as, of course, Hope of the Wicked by Ted Flynn, Rule by Secrecy by Jim Mars. All of these go into how we financed Adolf Hitler. And, of course, Gestapo Chief by Gregory Douglas, how we brought the head of the German Gestapo to the United States to live out his years comfortably in Berkeley, California.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go to Mike calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. Question or comment?
Just a question. I want to ask your guest if he knows anything about the FBI offices in the North Tower that were bombed out. This is the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th floors. They were bombed out independently of the airplane crashing.
Now, basically what you're talking about is that the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th chapter floor of the North Tower, as I remember, was where the FBI offices were, and of course they were immediately evacuated after the attack. Somebody went back in and found out that they'd been bombed, and of course the plane crashed in on the, you know, the 80th or 90th floor. Is that the point you're making?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then who bombed the FBI office at that day? So do you know anything at all about that, John?
I looked at some of the online stuff about bombings in the towers to make them come down. There's a lot of controversy. Some people said it's not possible. They could have just pancaked from the impact of the planes, that they were built to withstand that kind of thing. There's arguments that the steel melted. There's other arguments that, please, oh, steel, you need a Bessemer furnace. You're not going to do it with aviation gasoline. So that's the first I've heard about FBI offices being bombed, but I think there's quite a bit of plausibility to the idea that if this was all set up, then another thing that leads to that in that direction is, why did the World Trade Center number 7 go down? It was not hit by anything, and they were storing diesel fuel so many floors above the ground in violation of regulations. Giuliani was in on that. And that building also went down. You never hear about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are lots of unanswered questions. I sort of stay away from that because I quite frankly don't know. And I think there's so much other evidence, I like to stick with what I know rather than
conjecture. Yes, that was the philosophy of Ahmed when he wrote this book, is to stay away from anything that could lead the book to being thrown out as crackpot. Like there's the, on the other hand, in France, this Pentagate book had a terrific success. The idea being that it was actually a cruise missile, not a Boeing, that hit the Pentagon. And the latest twist on that is that all the people that they didn't like in the Pentagon, sort of the dissidents, they all called them and had a meeting, and then they killed them all with that cruise missile.
I've talked to Mr. Push, Stephen Push, whose wife was on Flight 77, and they actually found her remains in the in the wreckage there.
Is that right?
Yeah, and of course, I've talked to at least two people personally who saw the plane hit the Pentagon. So this is all part of this disinformation process, and you pick up that story, you know, why they'll shoot you in the foot, or you've shot yourself in the foot.
Yes.
My friend, Karen E. Bixman, actually tracked down six different people who had seen the plane hit the Pentagon, but I talked to two, and I have no reason to disbelieve what they said. So I think that they are intentionally throwing all these things out, as they did with the Kennedy assassination, so many
stories
that you don't know what to believe, and they're playing games with our mind. Well, Mike, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Yeah, one other. Given all the inconsistencies around the 9-1-1 attack, what do you suppose the chances are that those planes were brought in on autopilot rather than by some hijacker getting the controls?
Well, I don't think that's a terribly wild theory at all. Because that's how an autopilot works. You have a small transmitter, and it homes in on it. That would seem to me the most logical way to do it.
Well, of course, the people on board, the hijackers, and I think there probably were, I think there were hijackers there. I don't think that most of them had any idea what this was going to be all about.
Regarding the existence of hijackers at all, why do we believe that there were hijackers on at least three of the planes? On the fourth, the Flight 93, apparently there were some hijackers of some sort. But, you know, the flight manifests don't match up with the passenger lists and the severe lack of Arabic names.
They've never issued complete passenger manifests. And this German intelligence oversight parliamentarian, von Bülow, he found that very strange.
There are so many strange things, but one thing that is, that Barbara Olson, who I'd actually had the opportunity to interview before her death, and I forgot which one of the planes she was on.
77.
But was she on 77? Right, okay. But apparently she had cell phoned her husband to tell him, you know, what was happening. And so, I've actually heard both she and her husband speaking at a meeting I attended several months before the September 11th attack. I think that, and she said that there were hijackers on board. I think that we can get so far off on a lot of these things. These questions have all crossed my mind too, Mike, but I believe that there were hijackers on the planes. I just think that that maybe the hijackers didn't understand what was going to happen.
It's possible that only the pilots.
Only the pilots knew.
Even if you have it on autopilot, that even they didn't know. I don't. But there's also one theory that there's a technology to actually anti-hijack technology to take over control of planes from the ground. But I didn't put that in the book because this only came up from one source, and I couldn't find a corroborator anywhere.
The technology is there, but do we need that to explain what happened? And certainly they could have flown the planes into the buildings, although I know that many very experienced pilots say that you would have to have an awful lot of experience to do as expert a job as was done.
The Pentagon one, yes, because it seemed to have an actual spiral down to the right altitude, but right. I suppose an autopilot would tend to do that.
Autopilot would tend to do that. The question is, who was controlling the autopilot? Anything else there, Mike?
That's all, thanks.
Okay, thanks so very much. Well, if you're out there, we've got time for, really we don't have time for another question, as a matter of fact. Well, anyway, this is a fascinating book. This is beyond any shadow of a doubt, the best book I've read so far. It's almost 400 pages, And, of course, it covers a lot of the things we found on our own, but found an awful lot of things we haven't found. And I believe that this book is certainly the premier source of information. And, of course, it not only covers the events that led up to 9-1-1, the events of 9-1-1, and the unexplained things that happened, and the question as to why there were no planes in the air that morning. No fighter planes to defend America. Absolutely no planes. When they knew the attack was coming, somebody had to give orders that our planes were to be left on the ground. The fact that immediately after the attack, that they knew exactly where these people lived, so much about them. You just cannot explain these things by the way we've been told the story. But then, of course, the book then goes into the fact that this is being used to deprive the American people of their freedom. And I think that that is the strength of the book. It covers the entire gamut from the events that led up to this, the history of Afghanistan, the suffering of the Afghan people, and now, of course, America moving towards a police state.
Yep.
Well, what are the other thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners this evening?
Well, there was also the incident there where the couple of FBI agents actually were onto the plot and tried to tell the superiors, and these guys are still on a gag order, I think.
And now, where is that? I mean, I have not read the whole book. I've scanned it, and I've read about that in the foreword, but where is that covered?
I don't know exactly what page or anything,
but
there was
you mentioned that they had testified. Did they actually testify? We know that they had told David
Shipper. No, they're not allowed to. Yeah, David Shipper, that's the one. They're not allowed to testify, that's the thing.
Okay,
one of them called Richard Wright, I think.
Okay, well, they had actually told David Shippers about the attack ahead of time. He tried to tell people in Washington, D.C., and none of them would talk to him, even
right.
His good friend John Ashcroft. They called my friend, Dr. Garth Nicholson. They told him the attack was coming on the 11th of September, and it would involve the Pentagon.
Uh-huh.
They did not mention the World Trade Center, and he informed people highly placed in government.
Right.
Now,
Garth Nicholson, then?
Right, I do. Yeah, do you know Garth?
No, he's in there he's quoted in the book as a doctor who knows a lot of people in the establishment and who's
right.
trying to do that. And these FBI agents told Garth about it.
Apparently, yes. He had not only that, he'd been told by a member of the mafia about it. So he knew, and he'd tried to report that.
Yeah.
And obviously, they knew ahead of time, but they don't want the American people to know that. We're out of time. Thanks
okay.
so very much for being with us. God bless you. We'll like to get
Thank you
on other programs. Good night.
Good night.
All right. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time we have to bid adieu to our friends in the North. And please pray for America. Pray for revival. We're in real trouble. And I hope many of you will decide that you want to participate in this epic struggle with us. And so until Monday when we'll be back, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, Dr. Stanton back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future brings. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Well, we have with us right now Miss Deanna Fraser, and we want to ask her about the program as she's going, let's see, ask her questions to ease her into, okay, fine, she had put a message here that given in my my producer. Anyway, Deanna, how are you this evening?
I'm fine, and how are you?
I'm doing just fine. And, of course, your husband was a prisoner of the Iraqis of Saddam Hussein for a time. Was that during the time of the... of the war, of the Gulf War? Was that during the, when was that?
It was in 1990, just as the Gulf War started, just when Saddam closed Iraq.
All right, now what was your husband doing over there?
He was working for Bechtel.
All right, so he was a Bechtel employee, and what were they doing? Were they rebuilding some of the infrastructure of Iraq, or what?
They were building a refinery outside of Baghdad, Iraq, to put the Iraqis back to work after the war with Iran.
All right, and so this was a gasoline refinery, I assume?
With yes.
Okay, fine. And so they were building this factory, and then, of course, when it was obvious that there was going to be a war, your husband was actually arrested by the Iraqi government, by Saddam's government?
Well, actually, they were working over there for Bechtel, and they were subbed out to TechCor, which is an arm of the Iraqi military run by Saddam's brother. And,
go ahead.
They were staying in a hotel, the Ishtar Hotel, most of them were staying at in downtown Baghdad. And they weren't arrested at first. The doors of the country were just closed up all of a sudden, and no Americans could get in there or get out.
All right. Now, so then Bechtel Corporation, one of the largest corporations in America, was working with the wicked Saddam Hussein immediately prior to the Gulf War. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right, fine. And so the Americans have to understand that our corporations were working with Saddam Hussein right up until the Gulf War. In fact, of course, if you get into the background of what was happening, there were tremendous amounts of money that was under one guise or another being given to Saddam Hussein. And we'd given him a great deal of money for agricultural loans. And he would buy the agriculture and he'd sell the agriculture. He'd use the money then to buy armaments or finance all these grand schemes, and some bank down in the southern part of the United States and given him another $5 billion. In fact, it's an interesting story that when the bank manager was on trial and the judge kept demanding to know who had ordered the bank manager to give Saddam Hussein, this is a little tiny bank, and like your local bank in your community, and they're lending out $5 billion to Saddam Hussein. The judge kept saying, somebody obviously told you to do this. Who did it? And the bank manager, obviously frightened for his safety and the safety of his family, kept insisting, oh, shucks, it was just my idea. I thought I'd just lend out, $5 billion to Saddam Hussein. So we were giving him a tremendous amount of money in that period leading up to the Gulf War and he was using much of that to buy the armaments then that were used to kill Americans during the Gulf War. So, but then they sealed off the borders, and your husband's still there, and does he continue working then on this gasoline refinery?
We weren't married at the time.
Oh, you were not, okay.
So we weren't. I'll skip back just a second. We're both from Montana, Whitefish, Montana. We had gone to high school together and re-met at a 30-year high school reunion. Had never seen each other before that time until we graduated from high school. And we got together probably 2 years after that and were together just a matter of weeks, and he was stuck over in Baghdad, Iraq.
Okay, fine. So you were waiting and you were going to get married when he got back, was that it?
Yes.
All right, fine. So then, of course, they sealed the borders, and then does he continue working there at the refinery?
They continued working. They were bused from the hotel out to the job site. They were being very cautious. That was for a period of, I believe, 2 weeks.
All right, and then what happened?
Then they got word that they were going to be taken out into the desert as human shields, and they should go into hiding fast. And word, I think, came through the Canadian embassy, and they were to leave the hotel one or two or three at a time, and they managed to advise them to get over to the American ambassador's vacated residence. April had left days earlier, and there was no one there, so they did manage to all sneak in to the ambassador's vacated residence.
That was April Glaspie, the American ambassador, who had sort of more or less given Saddam Hussein permission to go to war with Kuwait. Or at least that was his interpretation, Saddam Hussein's interpretation of what she said. Okay, so then, of course, the American employees are in the American embassy, and they're hoping they'll be safe there?
The ambassador's residence,
okay.
Not the embassy.
I see, okay.
There were 54, eventually 54 men in a four-bedroom room. There were a few women in there for a short period of time, wives that had just been caught in this turmoil that were over visiting their husbands. So there were a few women and mostly men, but they did get those women out of there. The Iraqis got word to the women that they should go to the Iraqi embassy and fill out paperwork to get out of the country right away, and they did. While they were over there, word was sent to their husbands that they should leave their protected area and come to the Iraqi embassy and help sign these papers to get their wives out. While they were in there signing the papers, the military came and took those husbands away in front of the wives out into the desert as human shields. So the wives came back to the ambassador's residence just hysterical. They did get them out right away and on planes and got them out of the country. So it left 54 men in a four-bedroom area where they were surrounded by the military as hostages.
All right, so then what happened?
I was able to call Jack a few times on some kind of portable phone that they had. It took me forever, especially on one occasion. It was never less than 4 to 8 hours of dialing continually, but it took me up to 12 hours for one phone call, and I would be cut off in 4 or 5 minutes. We would be cut off in the middle of a sentence, and we were cautioned to be careful. Our phone calls could be taped, so there was some connection with him, and I knew at least that he was safe. Bechtel had called me. I called them because my last conversation from Jack at the hotel was, "If you don't hear from me again, sweetie, don't be alarmed." And he hung up. And I just went crazy, so I called Bechtel. They said, "Relax, we're taking care of everything. We'll call you back later in the day." They called me back later and said, "He's in a safe house, don't worry." And then it was some time before I could get through on the phone to reach him. So I spent many frantic days.
All right, so time is going on. I suppose, have any hostilities begun at this time? Has any of the bombing of Iraq begun, or is it still, are they sort of waiting for the hostilities to begin?
Yes, they were waiting for the hostilities to begin. Everything was more or less taking place in Kuwait.
All right. So then what happens next?
Well, I continued to have correspondence with Jack. He is diabetic and has other health problems. And as he was leaving the hotel that night, somebody grabbed a small suitcase from him. I believe it was an Iraqi guard or Iraqi military person, and it had all his medication in it. And I was so worried about it. And he was, of course, stressed. They were left in there without food and water, surrounded by the military, and they thought they could be killed at any moment. They didn't know if the military would cross over. It was extremely stressful. I was worried about Jack's medication. I don't know the exact number of days after. He was going over the wall at night with another gentleman and going into the souks to get food. And he was in the line once. He said there were maybe 100 people in line, and he was tan and dressed in black and trying to pass for an Iraqi. He said the military came by, and a little lady pulled him from the back of the line to the front of the line like they knew each other. And he was so appreciative forever to that little lady, and he looked casually at the military and raised his hand to wave, and they didn't go after him. That was one particular time they did not go after him. Other times they went after him, but he was in at the souks getting food. He said on numerous occasions he ran back and he scaled a 12-foot wall with his heart in his throat, dropped the bread, and jumped right over. But he did lose his eyesight in one eye while he was held hostage.
Now, this is because of his diabetes and he couldn't get treatment for it?
Yes.
All right, fine. And so things were pretty tough there for him, especially with his diabetes and the fact he couldn't get medical care. And so then what transpired?
Well, I was back in the United States, going absolutely crazy, of course, trying everything I could do to get him out. At one point, I did get a hold of Jesse Jackson's assistant. I saw him going into Iraq on TV and getting some people out. I tried to call the Dulles Airport, wasn't able to get a hold of him. I did finally run him down, and he agreed. His assistant called me back after weeks and weeks and said he would go in and get everybody out and I should get a list to him. Well, that wasn't a real popular idea, so that never transpired. I worked with... Go ahead.
Why wasn't that a popular idea? I mean, our administration didn't want to get the men out or what?
Well, I don't know to this day. Bechtel was not happy with me. And I, you know, probably shouldn't have been sticking my nose in where it shouldn't be. But it didn't transpire regardless. I finally got a hold of Jake West, who was a friend of Jack's and president of the iron workers in the United States and Canada. And he knew of Jack's problems with his health. And he started talking to people over in D.C., and Jack was on a list of people who were held hostage that had medical problems, and he managed to get attention drawn to Jack. So after months and months, they decided to go in after a few of those people. And they got Jack out after about 3.5 months. He was notified. They sent an embassy car over for him. He said he got into that car and tried to get out again. He was so upset at leaving the rest of them in there. And they pulled him back into the car. And he called me from Jordan. I should skip back a little bit. While he was held hostage, Dan Rather and a group managed to go in and interview these fellows who were held hostage, and I was called by his group from Jordan. They said they had a personal tape for me, and they mailed the tape to me when they got back into the United States, and it was from Jack, and it said, "Sweetie, I think we better get married if and when I ever get out of here." So it was very touching. And he eventually was let out.
All right.
That was my proposal.
All right, fine. So basically then he is released, but he's really in pretty poor health by this time. Is that correct?
Yes, he'd lost the sight in one eye. His blood pressure, he had had an open heart surgery, and his heart was not in bad shape. and he was emotionally in a bad shape, as I'm sure many of them were, going through night after night, not knowing if they would ever get out, what the situation would be, and they were held, I think, fairly close to a strategic plant or something of Saddam's.
And with the idea that maybe they would act as a human shield, if we would not bomb it if we knew that Americans were close. Is that it?
Yes, they were human shields.
All right, fine. So anyway, he gets out now, and then what happens?
He gets out, and he flew in to, he was brought into Jordan, and that's when he told me he had lost the sight in one eye. And then he flew into New York. While he was in New York at the airport, somebody unknowingly, not on purpose, ran over his foot with a big metal luggage cart, and his foot was in bad shape. But he stayed overnight in New York, and I got in my car in Montana at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I drove straight through to Los Angeles in 21 hours, I'm embarrassed to say. And I arrived at his daughter's house only to find out that Bechtel and everyone was looking for me to fly me to New York to see Jack while I was bounding around the highways. And he came in the next day to Los Angeles Airport, and Bechtel had gotten in touch with me, brought me to the airport, and they had part of the airport roped off for Jack to arrive. And I thought, this will be so embarrassing because nobody will be there. Well, there were tons of press people there. And he talked to them. Then we left, went to his daughter's house, and immediately the next day he had to be put in the hospital because his foot had gotten infected and was a major problem, and they thought for about 4 days they would have to amputate his foot. But he did survive that also, and his major stress, because that was before the holidays, was the guys he left behind.
Now, that would have been, what, December of 1990?
Yes.
Okay, fine. And so he's in the hospital, and his foot, I assume, improves, and is he discharged then from the hospital?
Yes, after about 2 weeks.
All right, fine. So, of course, then subsequently what happened?
Well, we got married the following January in Montana, Whitefish, Montana. He went over to Kuwait the following April to work for Bechtel again, and he worked helping get the oil well fires put out in Kuwait. And he was there just under a year. Then after that, we bought a casino and bar and restaurant in Whitefish, Montana, to kind of tie ourselves over. He's had numerous jobs with Bechtel since that time. The bar we bought is Jack's Diamondback, named after Jack. Ended up being an awful lot of work because Jack would be gone all the time working for Bechtel, and I was left by myself trying to run the bar. And don't know that I did such a great job of it. But eventually, we, along with some other people, decided to sue Saddam Hussein. And we instigated a lawsuit with him involving a lot of people. This has been ongoing for quite a few years. During that time, Jack went back to work for Bechtel. He worked in Uman in the Ukraine, dismantling some missiles according to the SALT treaty. He ended up with some health problems on that job, and he had just had open heart surgery, and he went back 2 weeks from the day to work in the Mideast. He didn't want to lose the opportunity to have a job, or not the Mideast, in the Ukraine. and he got back there, and it was 40 below zero about, and he had had open heart surgery 2 weeks from that day, and I think that was a little tough on him. Later, he went into Kazakhstan. That was really a tough job. By then, he had braces on his legs and some crutches. His diabetes went out of control when he was a hostage and had no medication, and he's never gotten it back in control again. He's had problems, and he's been in a continual downward spiral ever since then.
All right. So eventually then, you and how many other families brought a suit against Saddam Hussein?
Approximately 172.
Now, but these are the people who were all part of this hostage process over there?
Yes, they were all held within the Iraqi borders.
All right, so what happened when you took the case to court and sued Saddam Hussein for taking you hostage?
Well, it's been a long time. We were awarded last December. They made awards to 12 of the people in the lawsuit, and Jack did get the largest award of any of them because his health is so bad.
All right, Shine. Now, why didn't they give awards to everybody? Was it just the people who had some residual after being in prison, or what?
No, it's just that the case started with 12 people.
I see. Okay, fine.
Since that time, there have been awards in all of them.
All right. Now, of course, did the Iraqis send anybody over to defend their position here?
They did not. They had numerous occasions to be represented, and they never did represent themselves at all.
All right. So the court then automatically just awarded the people who had been hostages settlements, because there was no defense against it on the part of the government of Iraq. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right, so then what happened? Now the court has awarded you and your husband, or awarded your husband a substantial settlement. How much was the settlement?
$1.78 million.
Okay, almost $2 million. So then, of course, what happens at that point?
Well, we thought we were making progress, but all of a sudden the State Department stepped in and stopped. I should explain that we were trying to get money from Iraq.
There are
$2 million in frozen funds here.
There are $2 million in frozen funds? Just $2 million or what? The $2 million.
$2 billion.
$2 billion in Iraqi funds.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, those funds have been frozen here in the United States since the Iraq War.
I don't know exactly the timing on it, but they have been frozen for some time.
All right, I assume it would be since the Iraq War, because of course the Desert Storm, because prior to that we were shipping Saddam all sorts of money. So now there's $2 billion here, and of course I assume that your attorney anticipated getting the settlement out of those funds.
Absolutely. But the State Department blocked our ability to get the money. So then we were shocked to find out that we actually had a fight with the State Department.
So what was the State Department's rationale in blocking your access to the funds?
I haven't quite understood it yet. As far as I know, they want the use of those funds themselves.
Well, now, wait a minute. They can't take that money themselves, because of course it belongs to Iraq, and they may be blocked, but the State Department can't use the money, can they?
Well, they say they want to use it as leverage against Saddam.
Well, of course they can use it as leverage, but this is only $2 million out of $2 billion.
I know what we don't want much out of it compared to the amount that's there at all. We want just a bit of it.
All right, fine, but it would sound like our State Department then doesn't want you to get any sort of a settlement. And did they block the other people involved in the lawsuit from getting settlements as well?
Yes, they blocked the whole lawsuit.
But now, of course, do they want that money turned back to Saddam Hussein? What's going to happen to the money? It's just sitting in a bank, isn't it?
It is just sitting in a bank. So we filed a petition in New York against the State Department, the Treasury Department, and I believe it's Chase Manhattan and Bank of New York, and maybe a couple other banks, because we feel this isn't a legal way to proceed. And that is going to be addressed again, I believe, next week. We also had to get legislation passed that we've been working on forever that has to do with our lawsuit. And it says, we have a bill out there called the Harkin-Allen Bill, which says that victims of terrorism can receive compensation from frozen assets of terrorist countries.
Now, has that legislation been passed?
Well, it passed with flying colors. We are attached to the terrorism insurance bill, which is a bigger bill, and last night it passed in the House, and it will be brought up into the Senate probably Tuesday. This would be a huge step for us, of our major hurdle. Then it will go, assuming all goes well on Tuesday, it will go to President Bush for signing.
All right, fine. And so, but even if he does sign it, the State Department can still continue trying to block it, can't they?
They can.
And, of course, this is, I think, what people have to understand, is that we have, unfortunately, people within government who don't abide by the law. Certainly, the courts have told the Bush administration to turn over a lot of records to people who want to find out the evidence against this fellow Padilla, who's supposedly an enemy combatant, an American citizen, and there's another one being held, and of course the courts keep telling the administration to turn over the evidence, or to at least give the people a trial or a habeas corpus or, you know, access to lawyers, and the administration just says, we're not going to do it. We don't care what you say. We don't have to abide by your rules. And this is the rather frightening thing today. We seem to have an administration that seems it's above the Constitution and above this concept of law where we have separation of powers. Have you encountered that at all?
Well, I am, of course, very frustrated with the State Department. I'm very disappointed. I feel that they're sending out not the best message to Saddam when they won't even support their own victims of terrorism. So in that aspect of the government, I am very disappointed with the State Department.
Well, now, are they planning, or they intend then to turn that money back to the Iraqis, or is it simply because the banks need that money? Chase Manhattan Bank is in real financial trouble, and we know it was, this is what happened during the Iran hostage crisis, is that a lot of the reason behind that was simply the fact that Chase Manhattan Bank was holding $8 billion, I think it was, of the Shah of Iran's money. And there is no way that they could possibly release that money without having real financial problems. So they refused to release the money. And, of course, the Iranians would not return the hostages till we would give their money back to them. After it had been the Shah's money, it was really the money of the Iranian people. So we wouldn't release the money, and they wouldn't release the hostages until the new administration was in place. And that was a large part of the Iranian hostage crisis that the American people were never told about. And I sort of suspect that this may be part of the problem that you're having. Have you looked into this aspect of it at all, the fact that the banks need this money as part of their reserves?
I haven't looked into it, but it has occurred to me.
Right, and of course the whole system of our society is really built upon this credit concept of banking. If the banks don't have enough money for their reserves, why, of course, the whole system begins to implode, and especially today when we are having real financial problems, many of our banks really are on the verge of collapse. So will you actually look into that, do you think, and try to find out if this is part and parcel of what is influencing State Department policy, protecting of our banks and protecting of Saddam's money, rather than turning it over to the people who have a claim against it?
I will look into that. I just know that Jack and I need the money, too. He's dying. His days are numbered. He's gone from being a 6'5". Healthy, athletic man who has gone to work innocently with the blessings, I believe, of our State Department into foreign jobs that people think are so high paying. They're not that high paying for the risks and the hardships that they take. And now he's ended up kind of a forgotten man. He's in a nursing home, and the banks may need the money, but we need the money too, and I feel legally we've gone through everything.
All right, we're going to have to interrupt you because we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back here with Deanne Fraser. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and of course, if you are out there across America listening to us, we hope that many of you may be willing to join us in this epic struggle. Truly, it is a struggle for the very survival of America, because if people don't know the history, don't understand what's happening politically, geographically, spiritually, they really are incapable of interpreting the unfolding of events. And here is simply another example of our State Department coming out actively against our own citizens. And, of course, as we pointed out time and again, here our own government, a recent conflict with Lieutenant Commander Jack Daly, where he was blinded by a laser flash by a Soviet ship. And, of course, instead of trying to allow him to collect claims from this communist Soviet-owned freighter that flashed a laser at him, our government is siding with the Soviets. And here it almost just seems that our State Department is siding with Saddam Hussein against Deanne Fraser and her husband. So these are the sort of stories you must get out. And then hopefully you'll begin to understand that behind all of the apparent things that are going on, there are other forces. As we talk so often, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. And that's how we start our programs every day. Actually, that was said by Larry McDonald, Congressman Larry McDonald, who was very, very busy working very hard to expose the fact that the American State Department, American corporations were funding the Soviet Union. But that's a message that they couldn't allow to get out. And so Larry's plane was, of course, shot down over Sakhalin Island, Korean Flight 007, and all of the evidence shows that he survived and the passengers survived the shootdown, but of course never to be heard of again. And that whole thing covered up by our government. Why? Well, because we couldn't let the American people know that they'd survived or that they would have to release Larry McDonald. And Larry McDonald would probably be again pointing out the fact that our government has been working with the enemies of this country for many, many, many years. If you'd like the information on Larry McDonald, of course, we have it in book form in the suppressed CIA and government reports. Fascinating, fascinating material, even a four-tape set on the 007. Well, the information you're surely not going to get from most of our conservative organizations and never discussed on ABC, CBS, and NBC, all of which are owned by the same establishment. And even on, of course, Fox, which most people believe is the conservative answer to ABC, CBS, and NBC. And I'd like to suggest it is simply the Hegelian or dialectic response, but of course, we'll never tell you the real truth. So here on Radio Liberty, 5 hours every day, and of course on radio and on internet, on satellite and on shortwave, we're reaching out across America with the news behind the news, the story behind the story, and we hope that many of you will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family and help us in our efforts. And then if you're out there listening to us, I want to remind you about the program we're going to have a week from tomorrow. That's the 23rd of November at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, and it's going to be an all-day meeting, not at the golf course, but at the banquet hall there. Doors open at 8 o'clock in the morning and close at 6 o'clock in the evening. The program will go from 8:45 till 5 o'clock, and we'll have a number of speakers, Joan Parris, Jeannie Soderman, Brad Dacus, a regular who regularly appears here, Bill Sardi, all be discussing preparation financially for what lies ahead, because we're entering into very, very difficult times, and a lot of this ties in to our banks, which are really on the verge of collapse at the present time, because, of course, the monetary system that we adopted many years ago, and we'll go into great detail on the banking system, the concept of debt-backed currency rather than object-backed currency. And I think you'll find it a fascinating discussion. We'll talk about preparation for biological warfare attacks, because if you read the writings of the people who run America, and I'm talking about the Council on Foreign Relations, they're telling us there will be more biological attacks. In fact, they are suggesting now with this new committee on the continuity of government in case of a terrorist attack that much of our government itself may well be destroyed. And then how, of course, will they be able to control the population should that happen? We'll actually be having speakers on the committee on the continuance of government in case of a the cataclysmic event. They know what's about to happen. It's just that the average person doesn't. So it's about time that you and the other people begin to evaluate what's happening, prepare yourself, not only physically and from your general health, but spiritually for what lies ahead. So we hope that many of you will decide you'd like to attend that meeting. It's going to be a luncheon. There's going to be a syllabus we've put together. And we're hoping to see you there. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Please encourage your friends and family to come. We need to know how many people are going to be there. And we're hoping, of course, to see you as well. That is, of course, a week from tomorrow, November 23rd. And if you're going to be coming, we need to know ahead of time so we can make our preparations. The telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America truly is at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is Deanna Fraser, and we're talking about the lawsuit, of course, which she and a number of other people have brought against Saddam Hussein for taking him hostage. Her husband, of course, was diabetic and was without treatment for some time, and of course lost a vision in one eye during this period of time, and his diabetes had been pretty much out of control since then. And of course, the lawsuit was filed, it was won here in the United States, and yet of course our State Department has intervened. What is their justification, Deanna, for a refusal to allow you to obtain the money, which is actually being held here, the $2 billion of Iraqi funds which are frozen here in the United States? Deanna?
I don't know what their justification is.
Well, of course, has your lawyer been able to talk to them at all about it?
Well, the only way he's talked to them is to file a petition against them in New York. And that was probably 30 days ago, a little over 30 days ago. And we will find out some results on that Tuesday or Wednesday.
I see. So whether or not they will reply, what does your lawyer think? That they will acquiesce and allow you to claim the funds? Or does he think that they're going to just drag their feet and drag their feet and drag their feet as they always do when they don't want to give up funds?
I don't think he knows.
All right. And, of course, this is true then for all of the people who entered the lawsuit with you?
Yes. Yes, everything is blocked. The Iraqi funds are blocked, but the State Department is stopping disbursement of any of the funds that we were to receive after the award from the lawsuit.
And, sir, then what has the judge said who was involved in the lawsuit? Or does he have anything?
It was in a federal court, and it was Judge Thomas Thurgood Jackson, and he made the award, and I don't know how far it's gone, whether he would be brought into it. He just made the award. I don't know that he has to go any further in it. We are just trying to collect, and we can't.
Okay. So what do you hope to accomplish by being here with us on the radio this evening?
Well, I have been trying to get in to have a meeting with President Bush, and I've contacted the scheduling office several times. I was going to appeal to him for help. And I thought if anybody was out there and they wanted to fax a letter to the White House, they could do that if I could take the time to tell you the number.
Sure, go right ahead.
Okay, if they could fax a letter to 202-456-6208 to the attention of Bradley Blakeman, B-L-A-K-E-M-A-N, supporting a request from Deanna Frazier to receive an appointment with President Bush. That would mean so much to me. If anybody out there, I know that I don't rank very high on the totem pole, but if I could have 5 minutes of his time, I would go. I'm in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. We've moved here for Jack's health, and I would go out there immediately if President Bush would give me 5 minutes.
Well, now, of course, is the Bechtel Corporation helping you, or does he have any sort of medical coverage or health coverage or disability coverage from Bechtel?
He doesn't. We're trying to get something from Bechtel to help in his health, and they are fighting us every bit of the way. Jack has been awarded what I consider a small compensation for his health, and they are threatening to appeal that. That's been going on for 3 to 4 years. We're too small to fight everything.
Well, now, of course, was this workman's compensation claim?
Yes,
or what?
It is a workman's comp claim.
Ordinarily, of course, workman's comp is not overly generous, but
anything would be great.
But, of course, Bechtel is fighting the workman's compensation claim that you were granted?
Yes.
All right. Now, does he have Medicare or Social Security to help him?
We have a small amount of Social Security a month. We're trying to make ends meet on that.
Well, that's possible because Social Security, really, I don't know how anybody could live on Social Security today.
No, he gets like $14.75 a month, and I get probably $600 a month. And we got Medicare. I mean, that was such a blessing. And we still have health insurance that we pay for every month. So between Medicare and our health insurance and our Social Security, we're trying to survive.
Right. Well, I'm surprised that Bechtel would be fighting your workman's compensation award, and ordinarily that, of course, would include medical benefits ordinarily, and it does not. It just includes a financial stipend.
Well, actually, there was an award there for past medical, and his insurance company moved in before the award, and they filed a lien against the lawsuit, so they will get all of it to reimburse themselves for his past medical.
You're talking about your lawsuit?
This is the workman's comp lawsuit.
Oh, I see, the workman's compensation lawsuit.
Yes, the judge in the workman's comp lawsuit awarded Jack an amount for past medical, but his insurance company put a lien against that lawsuit, so they will get that money.
That is his private insurance, medical
yes.
insurance company?
Yes.
All right. That is pretty standard. I'm not surprised at that. But anyway, Bechtel, of course, is fighting the whole thing then.
They are fighting, and they said they will appeal. And I expect that they have told people they are appealing. They have told our attorney they're going to appeal, which will happen this coming week. And then it goes into more of a time frame, and I feel they're just waiting for Jack to die.
Well, is his health very, very poor at the present time?
It's terrible.
How old a man is Jack?
He's 65.
Okay, that's far younger than I am, but of course when you're diabetic, why, this just takes a terrible, terrible toll from you. Is he aware of his surroundings at the present time? Is it simply his incapacity because of weakness?
His mind is fine, but his body is wasting away, and he's in a rest home right now. I'm trying to get him back home. They're doing physical therapy, and we finally went to Medicaid to keep him there, and he's just in terrible shape. He's wasted away. He's just a shell of himself.
And so really, you do need these funds to maintain him and look after him in this through this difficult time for you, because certainly, I assume this is probably a convalescent hospital is in rather than a rest home, isn't it?
Well, it's a nursing home.
It's a nursing home, right. It's called convalescent hospital.
Yes.
In contrast to a rest home where
yes.
people are usually ambulatory, and then you go from a rest home to a convalescent home, a convalescent facility or certainly. So anyway, of course, this really is such a tragic, tragic situation for you and for him as well. And, of course, the tragedy is, of course, that the State Department is blocking you. And, of course, have you had any help at all from anybody in Congress that's, or any of the elected legislators concerned about the fact that the State Department seems to be siding with Saddam Hussein's funds, Saddam Hussein and his money, rather than with American citizens who were victims of his regime?
Yes, actually, we are getting a lot of help politically. I knock on doors all the time. Senator John Kyle has been a great help to us, Senator John Kyle of Arizona. And Max Baucus and Conrad Burns in Montana have been a great help to us. There are people that are listening out there.
All right, fine. And so what you'd really like would be for people to fax the president at 202-456-6208. That's 202-456-6208. And just ask him if he would be willing to meet with Deanna Fraser for a short consultation. Is that it?
Yes. He could sign our legislation, or he could sign and get us our money right now. But we need him desperately.
All right, fine. And, of course, again, the gentleman, attention, who at that telephone number? That is, what, Brian Blakeman?
Bradley Blakeman.
Blakeman. Okay, Bradley.
He is
Blakeman.
The Deputy Assistant to the President and Director of Appointments and Scheduling.
All right, fine. So have you been trying for some time to get a appointment with the President or what?
I have. The last time I tried was today.
Okay. So you keep trying and trying, and what sort of response are you getting from Bradley?
I got a letter from him the 20th of September saying the president would like very much to meet with me, but his schedule doesn't permit. But I will keep trying.
All right, of course, you're going to have to fly to Washington, D.C. to do that. But I'm sure that it would be well worthwhile if, he could get that. And even if they do pass the legislation, though, and it's already, you say it's already passed the House. Is it passed both the House and the Senate, or just the House?
No, just the House.
Okay, and that'll be going to the Senate. And, of course, this is an attachment, an amendment to the terrorism insurance bill?
Yes.
All right. But even if that does pass, does the State Department have to concur? In other words, can State Department officials continue to withhold that funding?
They can continue to withhold it until the president signs everything.
But even if the president does sign it, do they have to abide by the law? We certainly see this with the case of the Indians. They've been stealing money from the American Indians for many, many years. The large sums of money have been collected by the Department of the Interior, estimated somewhere between $10 and $100 billion of money that came from gas and oil rights, which, of course, the Indian Affairs Department said the Indians were too dumb to manage their own money, and to protect them, the government would manage it for them. And the government shredded all the records and refused both the last administration and Gail Norris and the current administration have been cited for contempt of the courts for refusing to pay the Indians, and they just won't pay the Indians. So, I mean, we seem to have people within government who seem to be above the law and seem to, when it comes to money, they just don't want to release it. Do you have that feeling that they seem to have their own agenda?
I do. I'm just hoping that with the backing of the House and the Senate, that we will get the backing of President Bush, and I'm hoping that that will do it.
Well, now, of course, is this just for you? Is this for everybody? Is this legislation really aimed at your problem?
Our bill is the Harkin-Allen bill, so that's aimed at not only our lawsuit, but all victims of terrorism from here on out receiving compensation from frozen assets of foreign countries, not of the United States, but of foreign terrorist countries.
Well, then would this apply to other people. For instance, there are a few living victims of the torture that was inflicted on American citizens by the Japanese during the Second World War, covered up by our government. But now, of course, the evidence has all come out, and these people were taken to a prison camp in Manchuria and used for medical experimentation. And they've tried to file lawsuits against the Japanese government for that, and they've been consistently blocked by our State Department. Would this legislation cover them as well, do you know?
I don't know how retroactive it would be, but I just know that it states victims of terrorism can receive compensation from frozen assets of terrorist countries.
Well, now, of course, is this considered an act of terrorism, or was this considered an act of war, or, the terminology terrorism, I'm not sure that we would associate what happened on September 11th with terrorism. Would they associate what happened to your husband as terrorism?
Well, I don't know. The bill is a lot longer than I'm stating to you. So I would have, you would have to pull it up and read all the specifics in it.
Well, of course, as far as you are concerned, it would cover your problem and your
yes.
husband's problem. And the other people, of course, who were involved with you.
Yes, all of them.
The other people in the same situation you are still trying to get their settlement?
Yes.
And what are they doing to try to get this thing rectified? Are they helping you or what? Are you working together, or are you working more or less by yourself?
I'm kind of working by myself.
Now, you said there were 12 families, though, that initially got settlements. Or at least were awarded settlements but got no money.
There are others that were awarded, too, but there were 12 that were heard before the judge.
Right.
So we were the first 12, and then there are others that have awards also. There are a lot out there.
All right. So, will they all be covered by this bill?
Yes.
And, of course, is there any sort of an organization that they have to try to rectify the problem?
Not that I'm aware of. I just happen to be the person who's out here. There was a large article in the Washington Post today on myself and Jack, probably 3 pages, one of the biggest human interest articles they've ever published.
Well, if you could get a copy of that and send that to me, I'd certainly appreciate it. I'd like to have that on file with this, with the story we did tonight. Would you be able to get a copy of that article for me?
Yes, I don't have one yet. I pulled one up from the computer, but I don't have an original copy yet. They're going to send one, but I could send you one from a computer.
Fine, I'd appreciate getting that. And I do have, probably I have our address, don't you?
No, I don't.
Well, you can... just send it to Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. That's Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063.
I have it.
Okay, fine. Well, we'd certainly appreciate getting that, and I'm glad you're getting a lot of publicity on this, and the fact that the Washington Post would do that, would suggest that you're going to get a lot of coverage out of that.
It's an outstanding article, and anybody listening out there can pull it up from www.washingtonpost.com.
And, of course, what's the headline
on it? It's the style section,
mm-hmm.
And it is the first page of that section, and it's under hostage situation, and it's regarding Jack Frazier, Frazier.
And the article then is just limited to Jack and yourself. It does not
yes.
cover any of the other hostages.
Oh, it is actually directed at Jack, and it does explain the whole situation. But it is focused on Jack because he is the one with the worst health problems of all those held within the boundaries of Iraq.
I see. Now, he was able, though, to work for a time. How long was he able to work after he was released as a hostage?
Well, he worked for almost a year in Kuwait.
Uh-huh.
And his diabetes was giving him little problems, very slight problems. And then he had to work to get other appointments with assignments from Bechtel and wait in between. So his next jobs were not too long. They sent him over for an office job to Louisville, Kentucky at one point. So he's worked sporadically. He's just the kind of a person that working meant a lot to him, to be able to get out and work.
But then he went to the Ukraine after that for a time, and then he went to Kazakhstan for a time?
Yes, and that was the last time he worked.
Right, and of course, how long was he in Kazakhstan, do you recall?
I believe it was about a year.
And does he do field work, or does he do mostly design work, or mostly inside work?
No, he does... He started in the crane business, and it was typically heavy construction, construction superintendent, overseas assignments. He started working, I think, for Bechtel in the 80s as a supervisor in Saudi Arabia, and he was... Somebody said he was the best structural steel man he'd ever met, meticulous and precise in his rigging calculations and devoted to safety.
Well, that's quite a commentary. Well, anyway, I want to thank you so very much for being with us this evening, Deanne. And of course, I hope pray that this will work out for you. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners this evening?
Just again, if they would be interested in dropping a line to the White House on their fax at 202-456-6208. If they're interested in pursuing any more information, there is a website, www.justiceforvictims.org. They can pick up information on this lawsuit and these hostages. And, of course, I would appreciate if they could get a hold of Bradley Blakeman and just urge that the president would take a few moments to meet with me so I could ask him for his support for Jack and all the other hostages.
All right. Well, fine. Thank you very much, Deanne. I appreciate you being with us this evening, and let's hope and pray that it works out for you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye, and thank you so much.
You're certainly welcome. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was Deanne Fraser, and of course, it's a really tragic, tragic story of a gentleman who, of course, was a hostage there in Iraq during the early phases of the Gulf War. And so this is the time when, of course, we want to remind you about our meeting we're going to be having on the 23rd, a week from tomorrow, out at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. And if you're going to be coming, please get your information in now. And of course, that's going to be all-day session. There's going to be a lunch, and there's going to be a syllabus, and that's a great syllabus. It's going to give you a lot of information you'll never get elsewhere. And I hope that you will learn a great deal about what you need to be doing now in preparation for the difficult times that I personally believe lie ahead. And so until Monday, we'll be back with you again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. And remember our telephone number, it's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. America truly is under siege today.
I got Dave to bring what I thought it was, but it